My name is Al Purdy. I write plays for CBC, which they buy at the rate of one for every 12 written. And I write poems. It used to be I couldn't sell the poems at all, but things are a little better now.
Tuesday night. No Other Country, the rural poems of Alfred Purdy, with narration by the author. The readers of the poems are Aileen Seaton and John Bethune.
I went wrong originally by having my first play accepted and produced on radio in 1955. This led to a strong suspicion on my part that I might be a great writer. My wife and I quit our jobs in 1956, emigrating from Vancouver to Montreal. And when you leave BC, the Chamber of Commerce generally calls it treason. In La Belle, Provence, my wife went to work in an office, and I went about the business of writing the great Canadian novel, play, or poem. Near the end of that first cold year in the Côte de Neige district of Montreal, I was feeling pretty desperate from lack of money, though Irving Layton and Louis Dudek tried to get me a job scrubbing off the blackboards where they taught school. In 1957, after writing a dozen failures, I had two plays accepted and produced in the CBC stage series. We parlayed the $1,000 proceeds into a down payment on a lot at Roblin Lake, near Ameliasburg, Ontario, plus a pile of used lumber and some roofing. My wife and I did most of the work on the resulting house ourselves, but never got enough money together to finish the job. The house remains to this day, covered with black tar paper instead of board siding. The two plays sold confirmed me in my belief that I was destined to be another Tennessee Williams, not to mention Shakespeare and Chekhov. From the date of the sale, I refused to work for anybody but myself. My wife, unreasonably, decided not to work either. Not because she was a writer, but she said if I could get away with it, she could too. All of which led to a noticeable strain in our marital relations. The Cold War was then at its height in international circles, and our home life wasn't so hot either. Building the house was also an adventure in its own way. I couldn't always be sure if dodging falling concrete blocks and objects flung at my head achieved a certain amount of velocity, despite my wife's ignorance of ballistics. She used to be a softball pitcher. But the house got built, despite interruptions. It was an A-frame with a high blue roof that you could see all the way across Roblin Lake. Then we settled down to a peaceful rural existence in Ontario, and I kept writing.
Spring Song. Old Father Me, in the classic rural tradition, listening to frogs ladder up loopholes in silence, making sexual abstinence the ultimate blasphemy. Rabbits turn, annoyed. Having shit on the garbage all winter in near privacy, they dislike this noisy interruption and skitter into the willows. Crying birds of passage are overheard in the clouds, plotting a better world for starlings. Old Father Me, a kindly papa figure, doing push-ups under an ancient Pontiac, attempting to change the oil. Include me out of it all? Never. Even the farm girl has my two eyes twinkling hard against her jiggling jelly buttocks, swaying down the lane to the mailbox, wearing shorts in fig leaf weather. I'm rueful but gratified at the young man's vehement twitching lechery inside an old man's inconvenient morals, under a senile Pontiac in the butter-yellow sunlight, attempting to change the oil. You be damned, you professionally unhappy philosophers, followers of anyone not alive, whether under or above the ground, those sick prophesiers of doom girls with two heads and four buttocks wriggling down the lane to the mailbox, which is much too much of a good thing for a man who can't make up his mind anyway. Besides, even upside down under a ton of metal, such mutations keep an old man on his toes. The world's pain is a little away from here, and the hawk's burst of speed that claws a fish from its glass house is earlier and later than now, under a rejuvenated Pontiac with frogs booming temporary sonatas for mortals and Beethoven crows thronging the June skies and everything still. Everything suddenly still. The sun, a hovering golden bird, and nothing moves. Soft clouds wait, like houses floating in the sky. and the storm beyond the horizon waiting high over the village of Emiliasburg, as if forever was now, and the grass roots knew it all. But they don't, you know. And here I am with my hands high under the skirts of the world, trying to figure it out. Too late. For someone breathed, or sighed, or spoke. The bright kaleidoscope alters. And here she comes lilting back from the mailbox. My God, I'll never get to change the oil.
I think many of us romanticize the open countryside, especially if our memories go back to a rural childhood, the lost innocence of youth, and that sort of thing. In this next poem, my own romanticism took the form of fantasy and self-derision. And yet, there were intense moments. Outside at night, when the teeth of winter gripped my body so hard the cold was a thing to briefly enjoy. And in spring, a muskrat's leisurely swimming and pushing shining water ribs ahead of him into the lake. And the timeless feeling that I was one human moment lost in an infinity of time.
One rural winter, trapped, cut off, marooned, like a city thief in a country jail. The rural mail, my only communication with outside, surrounded by nothing but beautiful trees. And I hate beautiful trees. I'm lost beyond even the remote boundaries of Emiliasburg. And I ask you, what could be more remote than a burg named after someone named Amelia, which even Amelia never heard of? Why, just close your eyes hard here, and you don't see little dots of light. You see fresh cow pads. But it's winter now, beyond the economic wall. I have 2 nickels, a dime, and quarter, and not a damn cent in my pockets. But a wife who comes out at night when I'm asleep and won't meet the burning stare of my closed, dreaming, womanless eyes. She's a damn coward, that's all. In the backyard, pieces of wood and stone embedded in ice. Notice the Freudian terminology, please. I'm trapped forever in the third post-atomic glacial period, making witty remarks like, "Cold out, ain't it, Jeek?" It's got so I'm even afraid to go outside. I might catch my foot on a lateral moraine or something and spend all my second childhood in Emiliasburg Township. The earth is frozen. The beautiful trees are frozen. Even the mailbox is frostbitten. And I'm getting a little chilly myself, living in a house I built one tropical summer with paranoid wife and battered thumbnails. But I got into this mess myself, and I ain't blaming the class struggle. Besides, I can genuinely fool myself that things are going to get better, in 10 or 20 years, maybe. And no doubt it does improve my character, walking half a mile to the outdoor toilet with a temperature at 40 below zero. But McLean's magazine provides interesting toilet tissue. Though all the spiders and microbes and things I trained to sit up and chant in unison, "Hallelujah, what a bum," to visiting imaginary females from the neighboring seminary, are frozen stiff. But the place is warm and comfortable as long as you keep your mind on the beautiful girl tacked on the wall, who advises me that spring is here and I should have my crankcase flushed out. Then, plunging back to the house, through skull-deep snow, alone, the wind steals all my internal heat. My heavy body is doped with wind and cold, and the house door drags me into the hall, and the doorknob is a handle I hold on to the sky with.
The craziest thing about living at Roblin Lake was that we started to like it. Oh, neither of us would have admitted that, but it was true, just the same. A neighbor let us use one corner of her plot for a garden. My wife quite enjoyed working in the sun, weeding and hoeing. I'd find a shady spot and help her along with timely advice, mentioning admiringly that exercise in the open air did her figure a world of good. There was no electricity. For lighting, we used coal oil lamps, and it took a cluster of 3 to read a book or cook dinner at night. For heat, we had a big kitchen stove and a Quebec heater. I wangled a couple of truckloads of railway ties as fuel, sawing them up on a borrowed machine powered by an old car motor. On winter nights from 0 to 20 below, I had to sit up reading and stocking the heater, or else I'd set the alarm clock for hour and a half intervals. If the fire went out, everything in the house started to freeze, including ourselves. Plumbing was crude. We just used the lake water. But near the end of winter, it was necessary to chop through more than 3 foot thick ice in order to drink coffee or wash your face. And the toilet? Well, I'll only say it was outside and responsible for a great deal of debate about going or not going. At first, ours was the only house at the southwest end of Roblin Lake. We'd sit outside in the long summer evenings while farm dogs barked in the distance and listen to night birds calling in the cedar country around. And sunsets spilled themselves over the lake like bad paintings suddenly authenticated between the elm-guarded shores. In winter, the wind blew for days, or so it seemed. Cedars behind the house waved tossing moose heads back and forth. Ice cracked like artillery in the lake. Rafters creaked and groaned. The battle of wills between my wife and I continued, unspoken. If it had come to words, they might have sounded like, "Honey, I wish you'd get a job like any normal husband, you lazy bastard." To which my unspoken reply was, "Writing the old woman in the Mayflowers." Like that old woman, I was bogged down while reaching for something and couldn't escape from the field of writing.
The Old Woman and the Mayflowers. The old woman went into a field for mayflowers and couldn't get out. The cracked voice that prevailed in 1,000 backyard quarrels broke in a bubble of saliva that popped and ran down her cheek like silver slime, and her mouth held the shape of a cry. The steel will that evicted uncounted boys from her apple tree turned out to be nothing more than an appetite for trouble. She bogged and died. It was some sort of hag tenderness, perhaps, that made her go there, ill-considered excess of feeling for beauty, or brain softening after almost 80 years of bitchiness, an era akin to the Peloponnesian Wars for some chronicler of Ameliasburg Township. She'd picked maybe 12 mayflowers before dying, and a goat ate them out of her hand, leaving the stems tight clutched. We think it was Mueller's goat. The tracks were deep and full of water, unmistakably cloven.
When animals die outside of cities, after decay in the teeth of other animals, after the attrition of wind, rain, and snow, their skeletons lie around on the earth like small works of art. The brain cavity of bone where pictures flashed is empty. The little area of heat that moved and had grace is silent. After a short time, a matter of a few years, even the bones vanish inside the moving cycle of change.
Skeleton by an old cedar. Now the bird's bones are little wires that thrum the air, and ants and other insects negotiate the girders. And small wing bones that slipped between raindrops and hemispheres are wrestled to earth by nothing but death, which had no form and shape in the bird's mind, but came just as the wingtips circled round this cedar to meet from another direction the black speck of his mate, flight wind opening gray down on her throat like a silver pulse. Circling the ragged cedar here he came, but never meeting her, 4 farms away down by the county road, instead encountering some violence that left no trace here, encountering a concept beyond animal understanding over the darkening pasture lands that stops all meetings and halts all travelers halfway home.
Once or twice it may have occurred to me that Roblin Lake was the country of my own defeat as a writer. But I was too egotistic to believe that for very long. Besides, I didn't feel like a loser, even though the black night of the soul descended occasionally by day. Not for long. I wrote plays, and the people in them walked through my head. Poems reeled drunkenly in the kitchen after lamps were blown out, and blue reflections of snow flickered inside the house. I worked when I couldn't avoid it. My wife and I were both employed at Mountain View Canning Factory during the tomato run. I sold apples, collected junk, drove a truck, all sorts of things. vowing noisily to stop damn quick when I became a famous author, and my genius was recognized by all, including my surest wife. At the time of our incarceration at Roblin Lake, we still owned an old red Chevy from Vancouver days and traveled around in it when we had money for gas, mostly in Prince Edward and Hastings County. Beer being comparatively expensive, I made wine from wild grapes growing in pastures along the snake fences of county roads. Winemaking is a great deal of work, a thing I'm not notably in love with. The pea-sized wild grapes of southern Ontario are easily picked. You can get a bushel in an hour in a good spot, but cleaning them is week-long drudgery, in which the sterling qualities of patience my wife says I have not got are evident to any unprejudiced observer. But 200 bottles of good red wine are a source of infinite satisfaction and joy to the parched soul. Hold up a glass to the light, and in the ruby inch or two, you can hear and feel your own undoubted genius pounding and echoing as if the glass were a seashell. And for a penniless writer, belief in his own genius is necessary and very comforting in company with a good bottle of wine.
The Winemaker's Beat Etude. I am picking wild grapes last year in a field, dragging down great lianas of vine, tearing at 20 feet of heavy infinite purple, having a veritable tug of war with Bacchus, who grins at me delightedly on the high branches of one of those stepchild apple trees, unloved by anything but tent caterpillars, and ghosts of old settlers become such strangers here. I am thinking what the grapes are thinking. That is, I am satisfied with the sun and eventual fermenting bubble talk together, then transformed and glinting with colored lights in a great Jeroboam that booms inside from the land beyond the world. In fact, I am satisfied with my own shortcomings, letting myself happen. Then I'm surrounded by cows, black and white ones, with tails. At first, I'm uncertain how to advise them, in mild protest or frank, manly invective. Then realize that the cows are right. It's me that's the trespasser. Of course, they are curious, perhaps wish to see me perform. I moo off key, I bark like a man, laugh like a dog. I talk like God, hoping they'll go away, so Bacchus and I can get on with it. Then I get logical, thinking if there was ever a feminine principle, cows are it. And why not? But what would so many females want? I address them like Brigham Young hastily. No, that's out. I won't do it. Absolutely not.
Contentment steals back among all this femininity. Thinking cows are together so much they must be nearly all lesbians, fondling each other's dugs by moonlight. Why, Sappho's own star-reaching soul shines inward and outward from the soft Aegean islands in these eyes, and I am dissolved like a salt lick instantly. Oh,
sodium chloride, prophylactic acid, gamma particles in suspension, aftershave lotion, rubbing alcohol.
Suddenly, I become the whole damn feminine principle. So happily noticing little tendrils of affection steal out from each to each, unshy, honest, encompassing golden calves in Israel and slum babies in Canada and a millionaire's brat left squalling on the toilet seat in Rockefeller Center. Oh, my sisters, I give purple milk.
In North Hastings County, where glaciers scrunch like white beasts, ice robbed the land of fertile soil 10,000 years ago, carrying it away to soft bottomland around the Great Lakes. When the good southern farmland was all occupied by settlers, a few pockets of fertile soil remained in the north. But successful farming is a borderline proposition in North Hastings. Small incidents in the farmer's life, a dead cow, a broken arm, early or late frost, are liable to make the difference. Human will and endurance measured against the limestone ridges. A contest without witnesses. A struggle that lasts for lifetimes. There used to be an old grist mill in Ameliasburg Village, 4 stories high with 3-foot-thick walls of gray stone. One corner of the building was badly cracked, and the mill wheel lay buried under 20 feet of rubble. Through a heavy growth of lilac, chokecherry, cedar, elm, and maple, You can still see the black gleam of the mill pond 100 yards below. It spreads across 3 or 4 acres, with dead trees rotting on its shallow, muddy bottom. Water that once powered the mill traveled along a straight, deep trench from Roblin Lake, 1/4 mile away. But now the trench is filled with rubbish, and the county road runs over it just before it reaches the mill site. Only in spring does water again roar under the road, and, failing to find the old mill wheel to push against, emerges from the hillside earth and streams unhindered into the black mill pond below. In August and September, only a small trickle seeps out near the vanished mill wheel, hardly enough to moisten the stony earth or turn the grass from brown to green. My first interest in the mill grew to a strong curiosity about the people who built it. What were they like, those old farmers, pioneers, dwellers in the deep woods, the men who worked from dawn to day's end, so tired the whole world wavered and reeled in their home-going vision? Then, after the heavy years of labor, their sons and daughters buried them in the land they'd worked to clear, a corner of the home farm no plow could touch. Most of the old ones were United Empire loyalists, come here to the wilderness after the American Revolution because they had no other place to go. The man who built the village mill in 1842 was Owen Roblin. He lived to be 97 and lies buried in Ameliasburg graveyard near the Black Mill Pond, with wife and scattered brood of sons nearby. I questioned old people in the village about Owen Roblin. It seems that once the village was prosperous, supported several factories and a hotel. After Owen died, his sons took over the mill. They rented it in 1916, but weren't satisfied with the money they received. The miller, a man named Taylor from Belleville, refused to pay more and walked out. The one remaining commercial enterprise in the village shut down and never operated again. After that, Ameliasburg, which was once Roblin's Mills, became a dead village, and the population dwindled. The mill was torn down in 1963 and reassembled in Toronto at Black Creek Pioneer Village. I think it lacks something in the new location. I doubt that you can hear the old voices that haggled and gossiped, arranged marriages and funerals, agreed on prices for flour, and were alive under the sun while the country around gradually changed from wilderness to farmland. Owen Roblin's own voice remains locked in the small geography of Ameliasburg, the mill pond under a green hillside, and the empty place where there was once a grist mill.
Roblin's Mills. The mill was torn down last year, and stone's internal gray light gives way to new green, a shading of surface color like the greenest apple of several. The spate of Martha's and Tabitha's incessant Hiram's and Joseph's is stemmed in the valley graveyard, where the censored quarrels of loving and the hatred and by golly gusto of a good crop of buckwheat and turnips end naturally as an agreement between friends in the sandy soil that would grow nothing but weeds or feed a few gaunt cattle. And the spring rain takes their bodies a little deeper down each year. Maybe the earliest settlers, some stern Martha or speechless Joseph, perhaps meet and mingle 1,000 feet down. And the story about the grist mill, rented in 1916 to a man named Taylor by the last of the Roblin family, who demanded a share of the profits. The lighting alters, and you can see how a bald man stood sturdily indignant and stamped away so hard the flour dust floated out from his clothes like a white nimbus round his body beneath the red scorn. Those old ones, you can hear them on a rural party line sometimes. When the copper wires sing before the number is dialed, and then your own words stall some distance from the house you said them in, lost in the fourth concession or dimension of whatever. A lump in your throat, an Adam's apple 1/2 mile down the road, permits their voices to float by on the party line sometimes. And you hang up then, So long now.
Clustered around Owen Roblin's grave in Ameliasburg are the tombstones of other early settlers. Huey Loyalists, half-pay soldiers, bearded lumbermen whose axes shaved away the great pine forests. In summer, a little creek bleeds out from our mill pond to the Saguin marshes that reach all the way to Belleville. A few ruined foundations indicate the 19th century village of Roblin's Mills. Scarcely anything now remains in the bright air, and yet those shadowy things are what we build on.
Music on a tombstone. In Roblin's Mills, old Owen Roblin came almost fully awake in his lifetime, once owned 6 houses and built an octagonal one. He slept alone with his woman beside him, beard outside the quilts in zero weather, breath smelling of snus and apple cider, dreaming not of houris and other men's wives, but his potash works and the sawmill, hearing only the hard-tusked music of wheels turning, and hardly ever heard anything soft. He did know one March that June was early. Didst thou then, old Owen, hear the robins? Built a gristmill, and a village gradually grew round it, and the deep woods vanished, and his wife whelped every 9 months. Eventually he died in his sleep, age 97, and everything ended.
Al, my wife said, why don't you get a job like any normal husband? One of my 2 heads, the one I use for saying nothing, nodded at the dear woman placatingly. My other head, the one I use for writing poems, began silently to compose an ode to celibacy in a Trappist monastery. Al, why don't you get a job? She went on bitterly. It was 1958, and early spring. Roblin Lake flooded the front lawn, about 2 feet of water above the grass, with amorous pikes spawning among the peonies. Al, why don't you? It would destroy our love for each other, I explained patiently. You wouldn't want that to happen, would you? I managed to get the bottle out of her hand in time. It contained nicely matured wild grape wine, and I didn't want to waste good wine in such a pointless argument. 1958. Frog voices overlapped in the spring air. The sun dazzled, and everything quivered. It was only time to look at things once before they changed. Cedars behind the house had vivid green sprays on the ends of their branches. Sparrows and starlings fought noisy battles over mortgaged nesting sites. The back house with chrome fittings leaned toward the south a little yearningly. A silvery feather floated down from the conjugation of 2 aeroplanes at 40,000 feet. Love was in the air. Al, why don't you? I killed her, then wrote some more poems.
Peonies beside the lake. We fed them potato peelings and rotten meat. We fed them fermented garbage for 5 years. While the stems sickened and leaves turned yellow, we fed them garden fertilizer and horseshit, begged from the only farmer with horses for miles. We gave what women have sometimes given who have no sons, and mourn their lost children in the menses of growing things which bear no fruit and cannot be eaten except by tongues of the eyes. Or the gentleness of senility in very old women, who really do not know why something aches inside them when a flower is born, as we are ignorant of our own motives after such a long time waiting to see how the new peonies shine, reddening the dull lake water.
When I was writing my pseudo-masterpieces at Roblin Lake, time used to get away in me. I'd work when I felt like work, sleep when sleep came. As a consequence, I'd wake up at any and all hours. Clocks ceased to exist, and the sun told its own time. Shadows pointed in any direction. Trees were 1,000 shades of green, depending on the time of waking. And the world looked slightly different every day. An infinite variety of coexisting worlds in the backyard.
Late rising at Roblin Lake. All hours the day begins. One may awake at dawn with bird cries streaking light to sound to song to colored silence, wake with sunstream shuttle threading through curtain shadows, dazzling eyes at 4 p.m. and 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. One may awake inside a moving house, earthbound by heart tick and clock beat only all one August afternoon. Once, why, stumbling, yawning, nude, to front window, there on the dock in noon fog, lit with his own slow self-strangeness, stood a tall blue heron. And the day began with him.
A storm is so big and a man so small that he needs an anchor, something to depend on, a familiar thing, a point of reference, a woman.
Winter at Roblin Lake. Seeing the sky darken and the fields turn brown and the lake lead gray as some enormous scrap of sheet metal and wind grabs the world around the equator, I am most thankful then for knowing about the little gold hairs on your belly.
Things happened for me at Roblin Lake. Felt things, so fleeting and instantaneous, you can only describe them, feel them again, I mean, in poems. Look at the heavy red peonies carved on air, for instance. Maybe if you're lucky, the word pictures in your mind don't dismiss them with how lovely, which is not seeing them at all. Instead, the sight of them adds up all at once to every time you've watered them, dug around them, or picked one for the kitchen table. Suddenly through your eyes. At the great blue herons nesting at the marshy east end of Roblin Lake. Maybe there's one moment when they too were lit up, emblazoned by circumstance. You know, stumbling frowsy out of sleep at noon, and there they are near the dock. A mind picture you can summon any time. And just as authentic as Rembrandt or Peter Bruegel, not to be forgotten. And what you don't forget goes with you. The things you loved on earth when we were here, before, suddenly, were not. Feelings, not things. A portable art gallery of feelings. Not peonies, not really, or blue herons, winter snow, and the golden look of a woman. They were only a catalyst, a trigger that made you feel life is important and feeling is important. Not moral philosophy, ethics, or the ultimate good of mankind. Big words that sometimes mean little. Just feelings and things that signify them. So, red peonies, a bushel of August snow, blue herons in summer of your mind, and the gold look of a woman. These will have to do.
Collecting the square root of -1, or stone blood makes thirsty vampires. To owe money, this the creditors think important. I have one eye always on the curious stranger asking questions about me in the village store, and the other on the rural mailbox, containing a viper, containing a piece of paper that says somebody incredibly, I don't believe it, owes me money. Broken agreements, contracts, promises, liens, and mortgages, each calling for a slight alteration of judgment of self. Every decision, word, thought, positive act, causes the sum of the parts of a man's self to change, and he betrays himself into the future day after uncertain day. Or else confirms the durable, fiery, inveterate bone into fossil virtue. But reappraisal, after the lost, lovely, cutaway pound of flesh turns rotten in the creditor's deep freeze, or he writhes on the bloody butcher's block and escapes screaming, tells the creditor to go to hell, makes a man nervously uncertain about the relative importance of front and rear doorbells. Owing money to friends is another thing. Owing favors, embarrassed smiles, small courtesies, suspended personal opinions, each of uncertain value but payable on smiling demand. And the puffed-up, momentarily powerful, friendly creditor annuls and invalidates all handshakes with notes to hand. However, flattery involves me happily in all this attention, that a creditor should think so valuable something it's possible for me to have. I'm glad to agree that the amount of the debt is worth much more than I am. He thinks it's worth more than the star-filled galaxy. Gold of the fabled Indies, dull glitter in a rural township, transmuted to odd shapes of honor, located in the duodenal intestine, the guts of a man hung up wet and heavy, drying on the snake fences, swinging ghost-like from power lines. Oh, creditors are importunate lovers here in the canceled sunlight, in the winter of my indebtedness, in the gray and quiet country where wooers yell imprecations under the faithless moon. And in the city, between the neon blinkings under the blanket of noise, Still in the darkness, lover to lover pleasantly insists, with the same flattery ascribes to the wished-for thing all value, that bodies open portals to each other according to reciprocal agreements, and unversed hands rehearse the earth music together, that smooth, beautiful faces contrive to contort and create the frog fetus which, leaping onto the gray sheets, shrieks and pries apart the lovers. This on demand, by prior agreement in parked automobiles, four-dimensional doorways, whispered moonlight rapprochement, negotiations on street corners, that the beautiful debt be paid, willingly or unwillingly, and with or without pleasure. Who's that come knocking at my door?
That first winter at the lake, rabbits chewed the bark from our only producing apple tree and killed it. They scampered over the snow crust in winter, left brown pellets even on our doorstep. They had no visible enemies but winter hunger and men with shotguns, and danced over the snow. I swear they felt as good as I did sometimes when the moonlit mood was on them. They never needed money. I made wild grape wine to drink in winter. They got drunk on moonlight.
Ameliasburg stew. In the bad days, no job and no money, living in this rural paradise among the friendly cannibals, eating rabbits when a neighbor killed one with his car, eating rabbit stew week after week sometimes, and life was not just a bowl of cherries.
In the moonlight on snowy fields, they dance and sing together, celebrating amnesty with dogs, running on their hind legs like furry people with cold pink noses. One of them points to this house near the county road and mutters to a friend, "That's the guy that eats us. He lives there." They shudder together. The pink noses turn white. A cloud hides the moon, and there's no one left in the snowy fields.
No, I can't eat rabbit. And a bloody patch on the road makes me remember the bad days and think this patch of smeared red jam on the highway will dance no more.
1959. Summer went by, and I thought, what happens when a magic spell goes on too long? The frogs still made their silly enchanted noises. Wild strawberries ripened and were picked in red handfuls. Crickets hung their continual high C over the countryside. But there was no money, no electricity, nor plumbing either. Without even saying it aloud, my wife and I knew we had to leave Roblin Lake. No miracles were about to happen. No fairy godmother or publisher's talent scout would wave their checkbooks and provide food, clothing, books, and a new dress for her. She claimed she needed one, but I thought the old flour bag still looked pretty good. Not once in the last 2 months did she said, "Al, why don't you?" etc. She didn't have to. So what happened? We went to Montreal in late summer of 1959, stayed with friends there, and both got jobs. Neither of us won the long unspoken battle, neither lost. And I am talking now long after, 8 years. The house is what it was. The countryside has vanished under winter snow. Cottagers have gone back to heated city apartments. Summer birds flown south. I haven't seen the blue herons for several years. I think they've left us for good. Wind whistles in swaying cedars, and a starved-looking sparrow pecks at a patch of bare ground. The place is alive with rabbits. Farther north, in Hastings County, where we drove last summer looking for another place to build a house, the forest is also filled with snow. Evergreens are draped with it. Leafless maple, oak, birch, and poplar are surrounded by snow. But if you look closely at the tree trunks, you can see where a circle of snow has melted around each of them from the slight warmth of life inside, and some rabbit tracks wandering off among the trees. The country where my grandfather lived and died. He was an old lumberjack, backwoods wrestler, and all-round hellraiser. When I was a kid, he used to tell me stories of the old days. Dead 30 years now, he stays in my mind. He's part of that country in the north, beyond cities, where the roads stop.
Elegy for a grandfather. Well, he died, I guess. They said he did. His wide whalebone hips will make a prehistoric barrow men of the future may find and perhaps may not. Where this man's relatives ducked their heads in real and pretended sorrow for the dearly beloved gone, thank Christ, to God after a bad century. A tough, big-bellied pharaoh with a deck of cards in his pocket and a Presbyterian grin. Maybe he did die, but the boy didn't understand it. The man knows now, and the scandal never grows old, of a happy lumberjack who lived on rotten whiskey and died of sin in Quaker Oats, age 90 or so. But all he was too much for any man to be, a life so full he couldn't include one more thing, nor tell the same story twice if he'd wanted to, and didn't. Just the same, he's dead. A sticky, religious voice folded his century sideways to get it out of sight and lowered him into the ground like someone still alive who made other people uncomfortable. Barn raiser and backwoods farmer. Become an old man in a one-room apartment over a dry goods store. And earth takes him as it takes more beautiful things. Populations of whole countries, museums and works of art. And women with such a glow it makes their background vanish. They vanish too. And Lesbia Singer in her sunny islands stopped when the sun went down. No, my grandfather was decidedly unbeautiful. 250 pounds of scarred slag. And I've somehow become his memory, taking on flesh and blood again, the way he imagined me, floating among the pictures in his mind, where his dead body is laid deep in the earth. And such a relied picture, perhaps, outlives any work of art, survives among its alternatives.
When I was a very small preschool child, the shapes of memory were just beginning. My grandfather was a giant of the first mythology I knew. When he was a young man of 80 and before, he lived in the woods, back counties of snow, where loggers rode down the rivers of spring, and wolves raced hungrily over moon miles. After the age of 80, he stranded like an angry derelict in the dusty little town of Trenton. At 90, he died.
My grandfather's country, Upper Hastings County. Highway 62 in red October, where the Canadian Shield hikes north, with southern birds gone now, through towns named for an English novel, a battle in Scotland, and Raleigh's dream of gold, Ivanhoe, Bannockburn, El Dorado, with Prepare to Meet Thy God on granite billboards. Light through the car window drapes a seat with silken yard goods. And over rock hills in my grandfather's country, where poplar, birch, and elm trees are yellow as blazing lemons, the maple and oak are red as the open mouth of a dinosaur that died for love of eating. Of course, other things are also marvelous. Sunsets happen if the atmospheric conditions are right, and the same goes for a blue sky. There are deserts like great yellow beds of flowers, where a man can walk and walk into identical distance, like an arrow lost in its own target. And a woman's scream and a grain of sand will fall on the other side of the yellow bowl 1,000 miles away. And all day long, like a wedge of obstinate silver, the moon is tempered and forged in yellow fire. It hangs beside a yellow sun and will not go down. And there are seas in the north so blue that a polar bear can climb one edge and walk the sky. And wave on wave of that high blue washes over the mind and sings to each component part of the hearing blood, a radiance that burns down the dark buildings of night and shines for 24 hours a day of long sea days, that is held trembling in a bubble of memory to remember summer by when the white pause begins. But the hill red has no such violence of endings. The woods are alive and gentle as well as cruel, unlike sand and sea. And if I must give my heart to anything, it will be here in the red glow, where failed farms sink back into earth, the clearings join and fences no longer divide, where the running animals gather their bodies together and pour themselves upward into the tips of falling leaves, with mindless fate that presumes a future. Earth that is discarded so much so long over the absent-minded centuries, has remembered the protein formula from the invincible mold. The chemicals that after selection select themselves. The muscles that kill and the nerves that twitch and rage. The mind light assigned no definite meaning, but self-regarding and product of the brain. An inside room where the files are kept. And a little lamp of intelligence burns sometimes with flickering irritation that it exists at all, that occasionally conceives what it cannot conceive, itself and the function of itself. Narrowing the problem down to a deaf mute in a wind tunnel, narrowing the problem down to a blind man in a hall of mirrors, narrowing the problem down. Day goes, or perhaps only light goes. Night comes black velvet, and the red glow fades. Leaves fall in my grandfather's country, mine too for that matter. Day returns, horizontal and gloomy. Leaves fall in the rain-colored light, exposing for ornithologists here and there in the future some empty, waiting bird's nests.
The time away from Roblin Lake is speeded up. In the last few years, I've wandered across Canada to the Caribou country of northern B.C., to Newfoundland, the prairies and Baffin Island, to Cuba and England. We are now moderately prosperous and certainly bourgeois, time and distance away. But I think both that time and that place remain superimposed on all that comes after. The shape of home, I guess, a faraway northern country whose edge we live on, in which a wind of the mind claims as our own. And there will never really be any other place or loyalty, no other country.
You've been listening to No Other Country, the rural poems of Alfred Purdy, with narration by the author. The readers of the poems were Aileen Seaton and John Bethune. Production in Toronto by Joseph Toft. Thank you.